At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
It's hard to know how to open up a podcast when you've done it at least a dozen times, you know? You feel like you're out of opening podcast ideas.
Yeah, like zippy little conversation topics.
Yes.
But yeah. You have one today.
Sure. good morning, aspiring clowns.
You are
listening to the wrong podcast because we're not talking about clownship. Or clowndom.
Clowndom.
But we're actually talking about the New Testament and Jesus today.
Clowncraft?
No clowncraft. And no, obviously, no podcast craft either here. Yeah. I'm joined by Ben Sternke and Christy Penley. My name is Matt Tebbe. Good day to you.
Good day.
Here we are.
Lovely to have you listening to the podcast today, listeners.
One of the public service philanthropic activities I'm committed to is educating everybody over the age of 13 how the Gen Alphas are speaking. And we've been doing this slang quiz. Remember this?
Yes, yeah, we have.
And we've done this a couple times before. A
couple times already. So here's, we have one word today. All right.
Okay.
Then the rules are you have to say your name
in
order to, quote, buzz in. And then you tell me what this word means in, you know, colloquial parlance. By the way, Gen Alpha doesn't talk like that. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready to win.
I'm ready.
Are you ready to win? Christy's like, we ain't playing unless I'm winning. All right. Yeah. The word is chopped.
Christy.
Chopped. Ben.
Christy.
I think it means like you lose. Like you're dead. You're out.
That is incorrect, Christy.
No, I don't think that's it.
Oh, so sad.
Ben?
I'm buzzing in with my name. Ben.
Okay.
My guess is that chopped means like ripped, like you have a bod, like your body, you've got very low body fat and you can see your muscles and you look good.
Yeah.
Without a shirt on.
Well, Ben, it brings me no joy to tell you that you're wrong as well.
Ah.
chopped is a term that is used to describe an unattractive or ugly person.
Like they're chopped.
So you can talk about someone or something like that. So you can say, hey, did you see Matt's new haircut? It's chopped.
It's chopped.
Or you could say his boyfriend or his girlfriend is chopped. So chopped is...
It's kind of mean.
That's super mean.
Yeah. It is.
I feel like Ben and I
didn't think that Gen Alpha was mean.
Well, I mean, is it... Listen. Is it more, does it sound more mean for me to say, hey, so-and-so, that person you want to date with is kind of chopped? Or, hey, so-and-so, that person you want to date with is kind of ugly?
I don't know.
I feel like chopped is a little less aggressive.
That's only because of how old you are. But,
That's true.
If you're 15, then chopped seems
chopped
equal.
Might be like, oh my gosh, that guy's swearing.
I've been around the Gen Alphas and the Gen Zs, out in the wild. They don't know that I'm listening, but I'm listening. Mm-hmm. And usually when this term is thrown around, that laughing ensues. So it's not typically used to like slam somebody, like in terms of like, it's not a real epithet, you know, or a slur. Mm-hmm. It's more of like it's used in a, at least when I've heard it, in a more sort of casual way, in a joking way. But it does mean unattractive, ugly, undesirable.
Mm. Okay.
Okay, I learned something new today.
Yeah, chopped. Way to go.
Add that. Put that in your put that in your lexicon.
All right. I'm storing it away. I'm hiding it in my heart.
Yeah.
Do you know someone who's not chopped?
Oh, nice. Very attractive. Dr. Nice. Paul Penley.
I mean, the best looking person we've ever had on this podcast.
Okay, Christy. Okay.
You our podcast listeners will never know that. They'll just have to take Christy's word for it.
All right. So Dr. Paul Penley, Paul Timothy Penley, is a good friend of ours, Christy's husband. He joins us today on the podcast to talk about his latest book. He and I went to seminary together. He got his PhD from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. His specialty is the historical context of Jesus and the Gospels, and which you will hear from the interview today. He spends a lot of his time overseeing overseeing funds for how to direct most effective ministry funds as the executive director of the Ledbetter Foundation. So he travels the world researching ministries and then helping to direct funds to places where they can have the most impact. He's published various commentaries on books of the Bible. He joined us previously to talk about his book, Reenacting the Way, his first book. And he joins us today to talk about his follow-up book, What Jesus Meant, How Ancient Conversations Redefine Jesus's Message. Listener, if I could just give you a pro tip, the first part of the interview is average. And then we decided to do an outro, and that's when the fireworks really started. That was Christy's favorite part. So make sure you listen to the outro because there's a lot more discussion there. Let's get into it with Dr. Paul.
Paul Penley, welcome to the Gravity Podcast! Woo-hoo! I've never interviewed a relative, let alone my husband, So I'm so glad you're here.
It's good to be here. It's kind of special to be with some folks that I go way back with. I've never had a live conversation like this with a wife, a friend of so many years I can't count, who's also recently changed his name, which so congratulations on that.
Thanks.
Formerly Matt Tebby.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's good to have you here, Paul. We should jump right into this. You've written a book.
Yeah. This isn't just for fun.
No.
Paul's done something serious. Paul's written a book.
It is going to be fun, but it's because of a new book that is coming out real soon. The book is called, as you already heard, What Jesus Meant, and we're going to talk about it today. This book has been 10 years in the making because you started it right after you wrote Reenacting the Way of Jesus, but then commentaries grabbed your attention and all of this other kind of stuff, and I'm curious to hear for you to tell our listeners, like, what pushed you to finish this book and why is it so important?
Yeah, it's definitely a project that got much longer than I thought, when I started putting the first chapters together. 10 years ago, lots of research went into it. But why finish now? I mean, part of it's just the rhythms of publishing, and the other part is finding like that common thread that binds it all together. And so I have a general passion, which was the same thing with Reenacting the Way of Jesus. It was go into the historical context, look at these mysterious actions of Jesus, and then when you put them actually in the cultural symbolism of the time, boom, you get this meaning you didn't expect. So I love doing that, to actually see what we miss because we're 2,000 years separated. But for What Jesus Meant, it was doing that same kind of research on Jesus's words, but waiting for them to come together. And they finally did, around this topic of how ancient conversations, when you put his words into conversations with a bunch of different particular groups of folks, then ah, that's like it unlocks it, because he wasn't making points. He was making counterpoints in live conversations. So that's why I finished what Jesus meant to finally say, ah, the material, I can throw this out. This is what should be included. And here's the package so that we can put this this way of making sure we listen to Jesus together.
Mm. Yeah. And so this is kind of a series, right? So the Reenacting the Way 10 years ago was about interpreting and understanding the actions of Jesus, that what he did was as important as what he said. And in this book, you focus on the actual words of Jesus or what Jesus taught. And in doing that, you're helping us reckon with what you call a my side bias, right? Where we don't often hear Jesus in his world, but we hear Jesus in our world. Can you help us understand what a my side bias is and how it impacts our interpretation of Scripture?
Yeah, we, in general, as human beings, have a really hard time like changing what we think from what we first thought. So what we've first heard, we have the sense of like, I know that now. Right. So research has been done on this, right? I mean, you can sit there and I mean, if you watch someone take a test, they get a 90 and someone else next to them gets a 70. And then they take a second test and all of a sudden that first person gets a 60 and the second person gets a 95. You'll still think the person who scored higher on the first test is smarter. Because you just have that sense of like, no, well, that's the smart kid. Something must have been wrong with the second test. Right. I mean, so we kind of trust our first read on things, and it's no different when we come to the Bible. And so whatever I first absorbed from maybe a church I was a part of when I was younger, whatever was the first author that influenced me, that just kind of controls what I think Scripture means. And then when I actually read more words of Jesus, I tend to find confirmation of what I already thought he taught, because that's what I'm looking for. And the reality is I find what I'm looking for because I'm purposefully or even unintentionally just blinded.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We talk about that sometimes as like a confirmation bias, or we use motivated reasoning. And there is something about our brains, our minds, where I think it's part of our like our DNA, our operating system, where it's really hard to change our minds. Once our minds are made up, we want to keep them made up. And so I think part of the gift of your book, Paul, is to encourage us, right? To exhort us even, that it's okay to change your mind. It's okay to change. Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard because you'll have to end up learning something that causes you to disagree with people that you've respected, mm-hmm. people that you've trusted. And that's just a tough relational break to say, wait a minute, mm-hmm. I used to be able to, I trusted that person. And, you know, and so it's hard. It's that advanced level emotional maturity that allows me to go, yeah, they weren't right about everything. Doesn't mean they were wrong about everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it that's, just means that's I've got to develop a wisdom to discern.
Yeah. That's why I've purposed not to respect anybody.
Yep.
True. Well, that just saved yourself from a lot of heartbreak.
Yep.
Yes.
Great idea.
Matt's all about nothing if not saving himself from heartbreak. So. Oh, sorry. Sorry, Matt.
It's true.
It felt like a fun joke.
It's totally true.
Okay. Yeah, so let's get into the meat of the book a little bit, Paul. You know, you say this my side bias is basically, you know, we have this sort of bias to believe what we originally thought about something, but we also have this bias to, like, one of the problems of the Gospels, right, is that we don't have access to the ancient conversations that Jesus was participating in and responding to, that everybody just kind of knew back then. Today, we have different questions about God, and we assume Jesus is responding to our questions about God, but to actually understand what Jesus was saying, we have to go way back and understand the actual arguments and debates that he was talking about. So for example, you know, rabbis, power, wealth, the Greek gods, all that kind of stuff. Maybe you could just give us an example by way of the story of the widow's mite, which most of our listeners probably know the story, but you know, it's about Jesus bringing the disciples' attention to this widow that comes to the temple and gives her, you know, her two pennies basically, into the temple treasury, 'cause it was all she had. And, you know, we've oftentimes interpreted this as Jesus commending the widow, for giving it all, you know, like giving everything she got, to the kingdom of God. And of course you, in the book, you disagree with this interpretation. And I wonder if you can just, by way of illustration, give us an interpretation of what Jesus was talking about here when he brought attention to this widow.
Yeah, that's a story that, like kind of many Christian principles or maybe platitudes that are pulled out of narratives in scripture, you know, has been used to promote, like, have the heart of the widow, like be a sacrificial giver, you know? And so this lady only had two little coins left and now they're gone. And that's how much she cares about God. And you should have the same heart.
Right.
But I describe it as more of a platitude because ultimately none of us then walk away and like put our house up for sale and, you know, the garage sale and empty the bank account, send to charity, whatever. So there's something in it where we're like, we love the aspiration, but we know that doesn't really make sense. So, you know, but we kind of get just stuck there and we don't really know what to do with it. So we just kind of live in the good aspiration, but no concrete action that I really know I'm going to take. So this happens, and I love getting rid of that stuff. I love getting rid of these ideas of like, yes, I want to call everyone to be this, even though it really doesn't make sense and it just kind of sits in the back of your head. So when you dive in, right? I mean, this is a story, you read it, and when you think like widow and temple treasury, and she gave money, and Jesus was like, whoa, that meant a lot more to her than it did to the rich guys who gave a lot, right? And so our minds go where our minds go, right? And so we just think like, we think about, oh, like, okay, generosity, like giving. But the problem is, right, I've got to read narratives in scripture. I've got to read the gospels, particularly like the gospel of Mark is clusters of stories. So I've got to read one story in terms of how it fits in with the smaller scenes around it. And here, when you read and you go, oh, a story about a widow doing something in the temple, if you're paying attention, if you're reading through, if you're not getting stuck at the end of the chapter of chapter 12, but you're like, you're reading right through and right in the beginning of what we think of as chapter 13, but you would go, oh, Jesus has just been talking about widows, and then he keeps talking about the temple, right? And so, oh, it all fits together. And then you just ask the question, like, how? How? Right? And the few verses before, Jesus has this great object lesson to show his disciples about the widow. He says, hey, there's religious leaders who dress in fancy clothes. They love to be on top of the world and looked at as amazing. But here's what they're actually doing to widows is they're cheating them out of all of their assets. Sometimes it's weird because your version might read like devouring their estates. And you're like, that doesn't land. No, people don't eat houses, you know, it's like not a thing. So, but you get into this issue of, okay, they're cheating widows out of their estates. And then you look at what does Jesus say afterwards? What he doesn't say, he doesn't talk about generosity at all. He doesn't talk about sacrificial hearts at all. He doesn't talk about like have the faith to like, what he talks about is people are ripping off old women. They're taking advantage of them, taking their money. And then he says, what's going to happen with the temple? I'm going to destroy the temple, right? I mean, as soon as he observes the widow giving, the next story is the disciples walking away going, look at how amazing those buildings are. Mm-hmm. They're huge. They're like the gold, the jewels, wow, I've never seen things so big, so bright. And Jesus is like, oh, you're really impressed with that architecture? Mm. I'm going to tear it all down. And you're like, wow, okay, Jesus hates fancy buildings. But
right.
But you go back to that story and you realize, no, the fancy building is where a widow came in, and the people who, the temple authorities, had convinced her that, like, God wants your last two coins. Yeah. And they had taken the whole law of God's heart, thrown it in the trash, because according to Deuteronomy 26 and what was supposed to happen with things given at a central location, in terms of tithing, it was supposed to be redistributed to the most vulnerable, and not just the priests, but the immigrants, the widows, the orphans. And so when she comes in, she shouldn't have been asked for a donation. She should have been stopped. Mm-hmm. And a priest who actually knew God's instructions in heart would have reached in and said, hey, take this home so that you can keep eating.
Yeah. So it's more like Jesus is drawing attention not to her sacrificial generosity, but to a whole system that is exploiting her, and basically saying, like, that's the reason this is coming under judgment, is the powerful are exploiting the weak.
Yeah, and we're go ahead. We're just set up to hear what we want to hear.
Yes.
Right. So we assume at the end of the story, when Jesus says she gave everything she had, and then repeats himself, all that she had to live on.
Right.
We think he's going, like, good job.
Right.
That he's saying, well done, and go and do likewise.
Right.
But he never says any of that. Like, but we feel it into there. That's that whole bias. We're just finding what we think should be there, as opposed to realizing the repetition is a Hebrew parallel exclamation point saying, no, the lady's broke. She's done. She can't feed herself tomorrow. She can't survive. And why? Because of this temple, because of how religious leaders have lost God's heart, are taking advantage of the vulnerable. They've turned God into a backwards Robin Hood who, you know, wants to take from the poor and give to the rich.
Yeah.
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 And so we miss that Jesus's call is, take down corrupt religious institutions that are taking advantage of the poor. That's not God's heart. And those places shouldn't wear the God badge on their work.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think we should take up an offering. That was a pretty good sermon.
Okay. Fired up about that.
Yeah, it's great. It's great, Paul. Thank you.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
You do this over and over, like every chapter. There are these things that we've, at least I heard when I was younger, when I was in college or whatever, and I had this interpretation, and you kind of help me understand a better way, a different way, an accurate way within the conversation of the day. But one of the things I love is that in these stories that you help bring clarity to, you also give examples of the good work that's being done around the world within these concepts that we're kind of learning, right? Like within the widow's mite, like who is, understanding, oh, we got to take care of the immigrant and the orphan and the widows, and doing it well rather than using God's name in a corrupt way and hurting people. And you do this because this is part, this is like your day job of evaluating nonprofits. And so you've done this for 15 plus years and have evaluated, I don't know, over 400 different organizations. And then you use some of the stories, the good stories, as examples of what Jesus meant in the ministry that's happening around the world. Can you just give us like one example, one beautiful story of how God is at work in and through a certain ministry as it comes to like, you know, something within your book?
Yeah, let's just stick with what it looks like to embrace and follow like Jesus's heart expressed in the widow's mite story. You know, because, and this is probably helpful for those who are living in, you know, some of the wealthy minority world aren't exposed to issues like this, but there are countries. For example, let's talk about what happens with widows in Uganda. Same thing happens in Zambia, many other countries, which is where the husband dies, and then that widow, maybe her three children, are there on their plot of land. They've got their home. They've got where they farm. That's how they feed themselves. And what happens in places like Uganda, 30% of the women, in Zambia, it's 50% or higher. Those widows will come and be threatened, forced off their land, potentially at machete, burned, killed. And so there's violent ways in which they're scared off their land. And then a male family member takes it. So it's an uncle or a brother-in-law, a nephew who comes and steals her land. And you would think like, that can't be going on. Like, seriously, no one would let that happen. And it's like, no, like in places, this is like, yeah, you got a 50-50 chance of this happening, because those are cultures where they still believe male family members own the land. Women don't have a right to it. So when the man dies, the male family, like, to take it back. So that's just what you think. And you don't think anything different until someone shows up and holds you accountable, like taps into your conscience, you know, gives you a different view and vision of the world, changes that those values that are making you blind to what happens. So yeah, one of the coolest things was I got to teach actually the real meaning behind the widow's temple donation to the staff of an organization called Redeem that operates in Uganda, because they are actually doing what Jesus talked about. They go in, they find those widows who've been run off their land, particularly those who've been run off their land by the highest standing members in the community. Because sometimes it's people who sit on the education boards and the village leadership who are still doing this type of activity. And so Redeem is a group that shows up and says, Hey, like right now, you have no option. Uganda has laws that say in theory this shouldn't be done, but practically the police will tell you that's a family matter. Just deal with it among yourselves. And so Redeem says, that's not good enough. And they tackle this issue. They have a process where they help the police do the investigation, assist with planning an arrest with local authorities. They bring in attorneys. They ultimately get convictions. And so they convict these land thieves. And then their last step is to publish it so that everybody knows, you take land from a widow, you're going to prison, and everyone's going to know about it. Right. So it's a whole deterrent strategy to say no more. What I love about their work, one, I couldn't, like, that work is more biblical than evangelistic organizations. If you talk about a theme that's just wired through scripture of God's heart for the most vulnerable and fighting for justice and saying, no one's too good to not be taken down for taking advantage of the most vulnerable. And so they're just continuing today the same battle that's all the way back in Genesis and Exodus and on through the storyline. And then, I mean, practically, I mean, if you've ever been involved in like trying to help folks struggling in poverty in Africa, you should ask the question, like, why doesn't it work? Like, why are still so many people stuck, right? And So this is a dynamic that just isn't talked about a lot or known much about, where consistently you could go and you could give an education to those kids, and then you could train the dad on how to farm, and you could train the mom on how to do basic banking at a small finance institution. But then when he dies and all of a sudden her and her kids all go into beggar level poverty in the community again, all of that intervention work you did to help them is erased. So it's a foundational issue. You know, you're trying to do economic development and help folks rise out of poverty. But the problem is there's giant trap doors all over the floor that people throw widows and orphans through, so they can't rise up the ladder over time. And so highly appreciate the work of Redeem and Jesse Rudy, their founder over there, who's just celebrated their like 1,000th arrest and their 100th criminal successful conviction here in the last 4 years.
Mm.
I love it. I love, you know, every chapter helps bring clarity to interpretation and then brings this, these practical ministries that are literally living it out today, this at this time. And like, of course, I'm saying that because I love you and you're my husband, but I don't see people do that in their books, right? And so I appreciate it.
Paul, something we talk about all the time, and I'm glad we finally have an expert on to talk about, is when is the rapture?
You know, one, it's coming soon, because it always has been.
No, you have you actually have a whole section. You have a whole section here on end times stuff, and I know that was part of your dissertation that you wrote 20 years ago, and it's still near and dear to your heart. What? Give us one or two things about how the Son of Man, quote, is returning, that you think Jesus maybe wants to challenge some of our preconceived notions about.
Yeah, well, I mean, since you started with the old rapture comment, you know, which really gets people twisted around, creates fear. You know, when you get taught like any day you should get ready to like have your body vacated from the earth, but really just your spirit, but somehow only your clothes will be left.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's, yeah. it
didn't really think it through, did we? I mean, not
yeah, really. Yeah. But you have these teachings, right, which sound cool, which sound interesting, and like maybe I should focus on that. That's very unusual. That's mysterious. That's like the sci-fi movies I like to watch. But then you go like, okay, is that a distraction actually from what Jesus wants us to be focused on? Like, and so where does that come from, right? And so I'm very interested in what Jesus teaches, and so you know that. That rapture idea has been tied for not forever, but since the late 1800s. So it's kind of a newer invention, and hopefully something that just kind of had its 100-year heyday of a mistake, and then we'll fade out into the sunset here shortly. But it comes from, you know, a misunderstanding of like Jesus saying, hey, yeah, like there's this big thing coming, and let me just tell you, like one person will be left and one will be taken. And again, we, you know, if someone's told you there's a time when people are going to be taken off the earth, then you'll go like, oh, taken means that. Right. So that's just another example of like, that's I'm going to find what I've been told is there. So what I'm interested in is like, no, like, let's make sure the ideas in our head are the ideas that would have been in the minds of the Jewish listeners during this rural conversation between Jesus's disciples and others. And then you go, oh, well, if you look at the language of when there's a big judgment and who's left and who's taken, well, you have stories using that language in Genesis. You have it in Ezekiel. You have it just running through the Old Testament. You can go back there and say, when Jeremiah said this, what did it mean? And none of them meant taken was a good thing. You'll be protected from a big battle on earth and be whisked away somewhere else into another safe realm. Never meant that. What it always meant was those who are taken are actually the ones who are wiped out, like in the flood. It means you die in the battle on earth. And those who are left, oh, they were spared. That's a good thing. You're alive. You made it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the remnant, the survivors of Israel through a judgment. And so, right, this is, you know, this is one of those cases where word meanings can change over time and actually, you know, start meaning their opposite, you know. And so this has happened with, like, taken was supposed to be like, you don't want to be that. And left, yes, you want to live. Like, you don't want to die. You want to be there after it all goes down. And we switched that around. Big historical reasons for that. But when you go back and you say, let me hear Jesus's words, the way someone engrossed in the Hebrew law and prophets would have heard him, then you would say, oh, yeah, he's talking about a big showdown coming up between some foreign nation invading Israel, and I want to make sure that I'm not there fighting a losing battle, getting killed in it, because he wants me to be around, to be a part of this new remnant, this new beautiful community that's going to spread across the globe.
Yeah. Well, that should help you, Ben.
Yeah, right? I'm not sure. I'm not sure about it, though. I think I'm going to stick with what I originally thought about the rapture when I was 16.
I mean, the rapture exercises are still good. I mean, yeah, you know, yeah, just getting those bodies, arms up there, yeah, for just being prepared at any moment.
Yeah,
so
just in case there is a huge war.
The exercise health, yeah, benefits.
Yeah, a man in Ben's condition needs to continue jumping out of his chair frequently during the day. Mm-hmm. Paul, a lot of this book is putting Jesus in conversation with Jewish sources from around his time or several hundred years past his time. How did you become interested in reading Jewish rabbis, Mishnah, Second Temple literature? When did that become important to you? And then maybe just say, like, what has been the overall gain or benefit for you in doing that?
Ooh. Yeah. I mean, that started
when he was born. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Absolutely, there's something to that. I mean, you're just like tapping into the way I'm wired at that point, which is I want to figure things out. You know, like, I'm a pretty simple, yeah, person. I want to like study something to figure out. I want to make sure it's practically beneficial. And then I got to go explain it to people. And that's all I do. And so what I found with historical context, like what I found with, you know, comparing ancient texts with similar language ideas to what's in scripture, you know, as soon as I read, you know, and my mind can go all the way back to like being in high school and finding this little, study Bible notes where I was like, what? How do we know that? Like, there's more than what's in the Bible that can actually give me a new framework for understanding what's there. And that became meaningful because what I observed, like at that age, you know, I'd listen to like one pastor guy up there on the stage, and then there was, you know, and then I'd go hear another one, and they might talk about the same passage, the same parable of Jesus, and this guy kind of embellishes the story and says it means this, and then this person takes it over here, and I'm like, you just taught the same thing to mean different things. And I'm sitting back there just going like, which of you is right? Is either of you right? Or can both of you be right? Like, how does this work? And so I was interested in like, where can you anchor that decision of actually going when Jesus says, my yoke is easy, you'll find rest for your souls if you come here. Like, how do I answer the question of, is he just saying like everybody who follows Jesus will have an easier life? Because that's what the youth pastor guy just said here tonight. But like, I don't think that's true. Feels nice kind of for a moment until you process it and then get super let down by how it doesn't pan out that way. But so for me, it was like, how do I make a decision? Because everyone would be like, yeah, trust and obey Jesus. And I'm like, that's great. But I just don't know what he's really saying to do. And so I need to anchor it to something. And that's when it came across like, oh, so if I've read the Mishnah, if I'm familiar with the stories of the most recent Jewish revolution in 1-2 Maccabees and ongoing commentaries in 3-4 Maccabees, then that will help me understand how we're using language about atonement, how we're using language about that we're finding in what Jesus says. So eventually that led to one too many degrees where you met me, where I lived in the library, getting that PhD, true. Sitting there going like, oh, look at this. Here's another 20 Jewish apocalypses to read that were written from 200 BC to 100 AD. Real page turners.
Yes, I'm glad that you wasted a lot of money and time there, because otherwise we wouldn't have met. So Paul, what is the hope then for this book? I mean, I know that you sort of like doing Bible research is sort of your hobby now, because you're researching these 501c3s and you're helping people channel funds into on the ground organizations that are having the most impact, doing the most good. And so then in your free time, when you're not having six kids crawl all over you, you spend time, writing commentaries and writing this book. So what is your hope that this book does for the people who read it?
Freedom. I think people are being disillusioned, disappointed by trying to follow instructions that they misunderstood from Jesus, to hold on to promises that don't come true because they were misrepresenting what point he was making. So for me, this whole thing gets us away from being distracted by the wrong things, putting our hope in stuff that only disappoints. For those who have thought like, I'm probably a bad giver because I didn't give all my money away, but I'll just learn to deal with that because all of us are sinners and thankfully God is great. Like, hopefully those folks, when they go through this and they go through the chapter on, can rich people follow Jesus? And they look at that widow's donation story and they're wrestling with those economic issues and they find some of the clearer instructions there on what God really wants for folks. Hopefully they're like freed from that worry of I'm a bad giver. Or they're freed from that mistaken hope of when Jesus said, you'll find rest for your souls when you come to me. Like that encouragement they were given of like, hey, you're going through hard times, but don't worry. Jesus is going to make it better. He promised to. Okay. Because his burden is light. He's going to lighten your load. Like so folks who have been hoping that would happen, who have been like, once my relationship gets easier here with my mother, or like once I don't have to struggle with my, okay, then my life will be good when Jesus comes through on this promise to ease things up. I'm interested in freedom from those mistaken hopes, focusing on the wrong things. And now a freedom to, there's always a freedom from and a freedom to, realize like, oh no, we need to correct corrupted like institutions, churches wearing the God badge, misrepresenting his values. Like, oh, there's work to be done in the world in so many ways from what's laid out here. Like, oh, the real thing about how his yoke is easy and load is light. I mean, the real rest was from excessive rules. Like, so we need to make, where in the world are we getting folks off on just telling them if you do these 10 things, God will like you and be happy with you and you can stop hating yourself inside and release people from that burden that he was really going after. So that's my hope for, that's why I write. That's why I teach.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we can end with just a final question that I actually don't know the answer to. I'm obviously, you write and you study and it benefits me and the kids, but it also, we have like a Sunday night group that really dissects and discusses and grows together in a community as we unpack and learn together kind of things that you're studying. But I'm wondering, like, what's your next project? Are there stories that you want to study and unpack that aren't in Reenacting the Way or What Jesus Meant? Like, do you have a third, or is there another project you're interested in? Like, as your wife, I'm just kind of wondering, like, what's next?
Immediately the next project is to release a revised and expanded edition of Reenacting the Way. You know, because over time, as you write, you know, you learn how to become a better writer, hopefully.
Yeah.
And certainly one of the lessons, you know, that I learned, because that first, you know, these books are intended, they've got little questions at the end of each chapter to be used with small groups. I got some feedback from some of the small groups who have used Reenacting the Way, who just said, like, the chapters are too long, you know? Hmm. And it's like that classic, like, you know, I mean, I started writing that, you know, like at the end of my time of being a full-time Bible professor, you know? And so I was just a little too content focused in terms of, more is better. Right. And so, I mean, that's the biggest difference between Reenacting the Way and What Jesus Meant is the chapters are like a third to half the size. And so just making it more palatable. So I'll go back and do that with the last one. Of course, I'm really excited more about the expanded part than the revised part, to be honest. So yes, shortening chapters, focusing content there, but pretty excited to add a new chapter on, all the Roman symbolism surrounding the crucifixion, particularly in the Gospel of Mark, and what that teaches us.
Ooh.
We'll be right back.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Let's get back to the show. Well, Paul, I think we about covered it.
We want people to buy the book and read it, so we can't disclose everything.
Yeah, there was one teaching of Jesus, though, that I did not see in your book, and I wondered if I could just ask you about it here off the cuff. Jesus said, there is a fine line between not listening and not caring, and I like to think that I walk that line every day of my life. Could you help us with that one?
See what I live with here, Paul? Oh, I mean,
yeah,
this, that's, I mean,
that's
it's crazy. It's wow. Crazy. Sorry, listener.
What?
Yeah. You better watch that. Like the translation you're using. Yeah.
Hang on a second. Let me do some Googling. hang on. Sorry. This makes for a really bad.
It's the ESV. Cause I don't read that.
Oh, okay. that was not Jesus. That was Jesus Mendoza.
Common name.
Sorry about that.
Very common name.
Common name.
Jesus.
Wrong Jesus. Paul. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I put you guys as an example in the book. So keep up the awesome work. I mean, you guys are phenomenal at, introducing people to tough stories, shaking up paradigms, rewriting frameworks. And, I love that. So, cause we've got to be shaken out of just what we thought before to really see something new, to really live a new way. So love what you guys do at Gravity, particularly through the cohorts, you know, getting people to find patterns and to kind of rewrite their own story. So way to be like Jesus and telling challenging stories and reframing paradigms and asking questions instead of just giving a whole bunch of answers.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
It's fun to have my two worlds combined.
Oh, look at this.
So as we close, Paul, where can people find you? Let's plug your pluggables if they want to read more.
They'll find me with you.
Oh, yeah. Come on.
How nice.
Sweet. No, he's on Instagram. Wow. Come on, friends.
Yeah. Paul's on Instagram.
And as most people know, to get to me, they just go to you. So, every now and again out there, Paul Penley on Twitter, probably one of the more content rich places to go is reenactingtheway.com. And so there I've got articles for, for the last 12 years on a lot of different Bible interpretation gone wrong. And so I'll put up different updates on there. So that's the best place to go.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks. I'll see you downstairs. All right. Peace, friends.
Bye-bye. Well, Paul, how'd we do?
I thought you'd ask some tougher questions, to be honest.
Yeah? What's a tough question that you thought I'd ask?
I thought you'd ask for the answer to like the chapter, can rich people follow Jesus?
Okay.
Because, I wrote that chapter directly for you.
Yeah.
So I hope you heard that message, but I thought you would be interested in the answer.
I'm interested in the answer.
This is one of the more hostile.
I don't feel like it's hostile. I feel like it's.
Well.
Appropriately, assertive.
So this is interesting, Paul, because I do think the wealthy in the scriptures, we often assume we have some patterns of thought in our modern world that I think hinder us from understanding the work that, quote, the wealthy are doing in the scriptures. So when the scriptures talk about the wealthy, who are they talking about? And why are they talking about them?
That's you're asking me like a serious question in an outro. I mean,
hey, this is our
part two of the joke. Interview. It's better than a joke.
We get to do what we want around here.
Whatever we want.
I'm taking your direct feedback, Paul, and I'm immediately addressing it.
Man, I highly appreciate the responsiveness, the care for what's on my heart. Man, the wealthy have kind of a tough look in scripture. I mean, it's like Jesus talked about him a lot. He just didn't say anything good.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
Which seems mean, which seems like that's like a harsh generalization. Like you must be missing the nuance.
There's this. Okay. So, all right, man. I have resisted long enough, but I feel sufficiently baited. So there's this habit in our modern world where anytime you start talking about Jesus's difficult teachings about economics, it's easier for a rich man to walk through easier for a rich man to walk through the eye of a needle than to enter the kingdom of God, et cetera, right? As soon as somebody like me does that, right, and starts, maybe I just put on Facebook, woe to the rich, in quotes, and then attribute it to Jesus, and then hit send, there's always the comment person who wants to include the other teachings of Jesus that soften that or contradict that. They want to accuse me of not including myself in being rich. And I have problems with that. I've got problems with that. Because the economy in Jesus's day didn't really have a middle class. There was the impoverished, dispossessed, destitute, hand to mouth. Then there was sort of this class of people in between that and sort of the retainer class / ultra wealthy who were basically scraping by, right? Tax collectors, fishermen, people who still owned land and could farm. And those people made up a minority of the population. And so there wasn't really a middle class, but there were people who had things like hired hands and fishing boats. Yeah. Whom I think are called to follow Jesus, but then we see them going back to their hired hands and fishing boats once they think that Jesus is done for. So there's calls to people like the rich young ruler and implicitly guys like Zacchaeus, and maybe the women who took care of Jesus and paid for all their festivals and feasts out of their own pockets. There are, I think, quote, wealthy people who are actually called to give their possessions to the community for disbursement and distribution. And then there's other people that do leave things, but they don't sell them off for some reason. Right. And I don't think we have a good accounting for who are the poor today and who are the wealthy today. And how do people like Ben Sternke, where does he fit? So could you tell us if Ben is poor or rich and what he should do?
And if I can follow Jesus?
That's my question.
Yeah, well, I know. I don't know all the details of.
I can send you my bank
statements.
From
what I know, Ben.
Send you bank statements?
Okay.
Would that be helpful?
Well, yeah. Since I'm familiar enough with the American economy, they'll probably do it. I know you're not poor, right? I mean, the tricky part of like this place where God was trying to get his people to live, when you look at some wisdom provided in like the Old Testament Proverbs, or when you're looking at Jesus saying a guy who is building bigger barns to store all of his excess stuff that he doesn't need, that's a problem. And then when he says like this widow who now has nothing to survive on tomorrow, that's a problem. Yeah. You see like, okay, this is, you know, too much is bad, too little is bad. There's something here in the middle, right? And that's described by, you know, one of my favorite old sages, old Augur. You know, you read Proverbs and it's a lot of like, here's some good thoughts from Solomon. And then in the end, you're like, here's a guy, Augur. He said a few things. And one of the things he said was, you know, I want to not be in such poverty where I end up stealing to survive. And I want to not be in such wealth where I think I have it all on my own. Who cares about the Lord and what he wants? You know, it's so that they're like principles, they're lines, they're relative to your economic context, as I understand it. You know, which is why like what you're saying, Matt, is a conversation that has to keep going on of like in our context today. Like, okay, what is being poor? What is not having enough to survive such that you're driven to economic crimes?
Yes. You talk about the prophetic tradition in your book. And you talk about how the prophets, I'm just going to read some excerpts. Gather around, kids. You have from Ben Sira, a rich person will use you as long as he can profit from it. But when you need him, he will leave you helpless. He will live with you as long as you have anything and gladly drain you dry. You go on to say, Jeremiah attributed greatness and wealth to deceit. The prophet Micah chalked it up to dishonest business dealings, extortion, and violence. Habakkuk pronounced judgment on those who were greedy, greedy profiteers. Quote, what sorrow awaits you who build big houses with money gained dishonestly. So all of that folds into what I think there's a consistent pattern in the scriptures. When the scriptures denounce wealth or the wealthy or the rich, their talk, and you could go into James here too, James 5, about the landowners that withhold the wages from the laborers. There's a consistent behavior of cheating, defrauding, extracting, withholding, dehumanizing behavior, where the wealth that's accumulated is done directly at the expense of people they're harming. Yes.
Yeah, that is, yes, right? I mean, if you've read through, you know, the way I tried to summarize it was, you know, there's two big issues with the rich. And that first one, I mean, dishonest gain, I feel like, I mean, it's like a translation, like a phrase in a lot of English translations that has no like power. It doesn't land. You know, it's like, oh yeah, you don't want to do dishonest gain, whatever that is. But I think it's, you know, it's this issue of you're supposed to be upholding justice. When you don't, what it looks like is taking advantage of people or ripping them off. And so what you're describing was so common, right? To be someone who had amassed land, because assets is really where the wealth is, to be someone in Jesus's day who had a bunch of properties. How did you get there? Well, you got there by a family has a hard time. They come to you and say, I need a little money in order to buy seed and try and farm next year. And then it doesn't turn out well. And so you foreclose on the loan and confiscate their land, and you just go and pick off one vulnerable person after another, building your wealth. They challenge you in court, but you can pay off the judges. You've got more clout because of your position, right? So that's how people got wealthy, which is why Jesus can show up and say, those of you who have excess wealth, judgment's coming. He doesn't say there's just a few bad billionaires. He says, like, there is a systemic problem here. You didn't get that way except for taking advantage of people, which is the same thing you see back in the prophets, like Isaiah 58, where Isaiah is like, I don't want you to fast today. God's not even going to listen to your prayers. When you pray, he's not even hearing it. He's not interested in how spiritual you are when you worship today. He just cares that you didn't pay your workers what they're worth back on your land.
Yes. Yes. So I think we have to do more work than simply when somebody says, woe to the rich, respond to them by saying, but if you take the entire global economy, you're in the top 1%. So you can't say woe to the rich because you're more wealthy than the person who's living in the street in El Salvador. Not because I don't think we don't need to reckon with the relative affluence of our culture and how people like Ben Sternke, for instance, is more wealthy than that person living on the street in El Salvador or New York City, you know, or Shelbyville, Indiana. But because I think that I'd like to actually start where the scriptures start and deal with what the scriptures deal with, because I think until we do, we can't reckon with guys like Ben and me and you, Paul and you, Christy, our complicity and culpability in our political economy. Meaning, we are trying to stay alive and survive in a political economy that's been built and sustained by and protected by people who people who own the land. And the land now isn't actual plots of property, but the land is markets. You know, the land is entire industries, right? And so I think there's a needed reckoning about economics at all levels. But because, for instance, the poor can be greedy, right, in Jesus's day. But it is the greed of the people who have the poor's land that Jesus most often talks about.
Yeah.
So it's not that the poor can't be greedy. It's that there's a greater problem that Jesus is trying to address, which is we haven't practiced Jubilee for a hot minute. And people are dying because they are giving their coat for collateral because they no longer have land and they're walking around in their underwear. We have a society full of wealthy, rich people who have accumulated ancestral land, who are taking people's very clothes off their back because they have to take out loans because they no longer are able to make a living with the land that should provide for them, because I, the wealthy person, already have that, and now I have their coat too. So what I want to say is, we have that situation today. That still exists, right? That kind of exploitation and injustice still exists. And I guess what I'm contending for in this ridiculous outro we're doing.
This is ridiculous. I will just register that. Go on.
There is no symmetry. There is no equal and commiserate wrong between the person walking around in their underwear and the greed in their life and the person who has made that person walk around in their underwear and the greed in their life.
And that's why everyone should read that chapter in your Mind of Christ book about God's love reckons with power.
Come on.
Because that tension is there. Absolutely. You know, people,
right?
You know,
Paul, how am I framing this? Would you take issue with any way I'm framing that? Is what I'm asking you.
No. I mean, I take issue with sometimes how you go after and attack people and focus on who's getting it wrong that is powerful, but on the framing, no, you're talking about like just that typical dynamic of people with more power are more accountable. And that's it makes sense. It makes economic sense. That's how the world works, that how social structures work. Those in power controlling the institutions, the processes, the laws, et cetera. Yeah, I mean, that affects a whole bunch of other people's lives more than their own. So it just makes sense that they would be more accountable. But that's the story of the prophetic voice across scripture, is just going after those who are the wealthy, who are in the royal court, who might be the king, who whatever they are, and saying, you have a responsibility. Like if you there's either a problem because there was a lot of injustice and taking advantage of people and how you got wealthy, or there's a problem because you're now like thinking it's yours, like, and you're hoarding what you don't need, power, privilege, et cetera, to the pain of other people that can't do anything about it. And so it's on you to make the change, because the folks down there that don't have that power can't just rewrite the laws, can't just make that happen. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think in our democratic mindset, or our, like, we excuse like the sense of human equality with like, okay, so every individual or person or, you know, it's like has the same effect on people's lives, mm-hmm. or just like should be held to the same standard, as opposed to like, no, if your decisions and your power and what you're sitting on top of is affecting a million people, and what I sit on top of is affecting 10. Sorry, it's kind of a bigger deal that you write that ship.
Yeah. If in my greed, I steal a fry from your plate and you go hungry because you didn't get your full plate of fries, that's different than if in my greed, I cause hundreds of thousands of people to die because I took away their food and healthcare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, I'm concerned with trying to figure out a way of bringing the scriptures to bear on those kinds of things, not to excuse the relative wealth of the West in comparison to the world that's not as wealthy, but because I think that the world that's not as wealthy and the relative wealth of the West are all living inside of a political economy that would be denounced by Jesus. And so I don't really want to waste my, I don't want to waste my energy on wagging my finger at a poor person who I think is lazy, or critiquing Ben Sternke as having an equal and commensurate sort of wrongdoing when it comes to greed as, you know, that Fox, Elon Musk. There, I did it. I called somebody a name. You know, the skullduggery, that the jiggery pokery.
Like this? Is that allowed?
That he's up to. Anyway, there, we talked about economics, Paul. Any other critiques or our interview?
I've been quiet because I don't really love the bantering and the arguing, and I just want everyone to be friends and happy. But this is what I'm...
You think we're arguing? I think there's simpatico here. I think we're vibing.
My point is that maybe any of our listeners, because I'm like the practical, like, how does this impact my life? What does this mean for me? Like tomorrow, today, this afternoon. And I think like the question of thinking through wealth and what you have and what does it look like to love the people in front of you? And so what line item in my budget can be used to actually help somebody else? And just be practical about it.
So can I give you an analogy, Christy?
Yeah.
Because I want to do that work. But do you know that the Keep America Beautiful campaign, the invention of the word litter bug, was created by a PR firm that was working for the multinational, multi-billion-dollar corporations that were contributing the most carbon emissions in our environment back in the 70s and 80s. And the PR campaign essentially was two things. One, it was to rehabilitate these corporations that were, you know, polluting the land and contributing to what we would call climate change. But two, it was to create a virtue or value and the burden of responsibility on people like me when I polish off that Coke Zero to throw my can into the recycle bin and think I've done my part. And if I don't do that, there's now kind of a social, you don't recycle? Why don't you recycle? Oh, that's awful. You should be recycling. Now, I recycle. I love recycling, but I'm throwing cans into a recycle bin to take care of the environment. Meanwhile, trillions of chemicals are being pumped into the environment by the people who created the social expectation and value that the way to protect the environment is by people like you and me throwing a can or two into a bin. Like that's principality and power stuff for me.
Yeah.
That's like, so we can have the conversation of should we recycle? I think we should. But why do we value recycling? Who created Keep America Beautiful and Litter Bug? And why would they create that? Because they're doing egregiously, exponentially worse stuff than me throwing away an aluminum can. And they want a PR rehabilitation, but that they, quote, care for the environment, and they want to displace the burden of care onto ordinary people so that corporations can get away with, Paul, you know, I'm going to say it, skullduggery. And so I think the same thing happens with wealth. The landowners who withhold the wages, and our economy would collapse if landholders stop withholding wages. They want to shift the conversation from that to, Chrissy, are you being greedy? Are you recycling that can? And again, we can have the conversation about recycling that can. But for me, there's a larger program here of how that works in our culture. I mean, for instance, Paul, you go in your book. By the way, is this a separate podcast now? Maybe this is just for us. You go in your book on the Sermon on the Mount, right? You've heard it said, but I say to you. Yep. Right? And Jesus is actually, and you talk about the translation of how the English translations get it wrong about if you divorce your wife for anything other than sexual morality. Our translations give the impression that the one who's doing the divorcing, the man, is causing the woman to commit adultery.
Yeah.
But you point out that that's a mistranslation, and it's actually the man committing adultery. Right? Mm-hmm. So here's the point. Jesus is teaching specifically to an audience all the way through the Sermon on the Mount and in large portions of the Gospels where men or powerful people are using Torah or using the law or using the scriptures to harm people. Like, but they say they're following the law, but they're using the law in a way that violates people, right? And Jesus is really keen on two things: upholding the law, his interpretation of it, and being an advocate for the people who get misused by the leaders using the law for their own benefit. And I think what I'm advocating for here is something similar to that. Like, it's not, is the law valid or not? It's, how are people using the law to put an undue burden onto women who got a certificate of divorce, and now they have to walk around with a scarlet letter on their chest?
Yeah. This is, I mean, it's like with James 3, the teaching about teachers. I mean, that says, you know, because if I mislead one other guy sitting next to me, okay, that's bad. That's a problem. But if the person leading the whole group teaches 100 of us the wrong, sends 100 of us in the wrong direction, like, there's a greater consequence for that. And James 3 says, like, there's a greater judgment for that influential teacher, right? I mean, you know, so those, you know, the power you have has to be taken into consideration. We know this, right? Like, as a parent, I have to carefully steward, you know, that the reality is my words are more powerful over my kids than their words are over me. And so it's like, okay, that, you know, so what happens there? I've got to hold that responsibility. I've got to be more intentional, more careful, because of how it influences. So just, I mean, that goes all the way up to the, you know, the company that's finding a way to push profits by poisoning rivers with not thinking, yes, about how they dispose of their products. And, you know, it's like, who cares that there's mercury in the fish that people are getting, you know, it's like, but look at this, our stock price, you know? And so yeah. There's that thing of like, well, no one else in the neighborhood even has the ability to put that much toxic chemicals in the river. Like, so there are folks with a disproportionate potential for negative or positive influence that therefore should have an unusually high, a disproportionate amount of accountability, you know, a standard to which they are held because of the impact it has.
Well, I'm glad we've had this chat. Chrissy, are you okay?
I'm glad people I love are all connecting.
You know, Paul and I don't get to do this very much. Do you know how few people I have in my life that want to listen to my incoherent ramblings?
It's great.
I've about worn Ben out. This is good. This is good.
It's fun. And Matt, I'll tell you, it's even more fun when you're part of groups that are like really taking down those with power and changing the system. I mean, that's why I love being a part of the work of Redeem International, because it's like we're really breaking up one group of village leaders, one group like that are oppressing widows and kids like on a generational basis. It's like, no, we're rewriting the laws, their enforcement, you know, the authorities, where the responsibility lands. That becomes fun, because if you can change what those in power are doing, then, you know, it's like the projective impact of their work so far is like, then you can deter a whole bunch of bad behavior and ultimately protect millions of lives from not being subject to a corrupted system that perpetuates itself.
You know, I want to propose something here, Paul. I would love to have you come back on the podcast. And I would love to hear you talk about some of these organizations that you've looked at and the work they're doing. I think part of what can sustain hope for a lot of us is hearing like good, hopeful things that are happening around the world, and how you and your role in helping those organizations be funded. Are you up for that?
Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah, that's where my heart is. That's where my head always is trying to find the next group that's getting it right.
All right. Well, we got to get out of here. This outro has been embarrassingly long. Real quick, Paul, before we go, do you know who I saw today?
It's Adam Gustine.
No. Everyone I looked
Madonna.
At.
Madonna?
I'm sorry, Paul. This is what happens to me every time. And I'm so glad it wasn't me this time.
I love what, Chrissy. The joke maybe didn't even land for Paul. I love that too.
I don't even
He's still
think
trying
he
to figure it out. Was it Madonna? That's great. This is even better than Chrissy.
Did you hear what I said, Paul? The joke. Paul, did you hear what I said?
No, your delivery was so subtle when I got so excited
that you had seen Madonna.
I didn't hear what you said.
I asked you, do you know who I saw today? And then I said, everyone I looked at. Well, you don't
probably,
like
it was probably better that we didn't rewind that one.
Mm-hmm. You don't like my you don't like my vision joke? Well, too bad. That's how I roll.
No, I'll share it with my kids, my younger kids. Oh, yeah.
Was the joke too cornea for you?
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Okay, on that note, y'all, have a great day, listener.
We're stressing Christy out.
Let's get out of here.
I am the master, you are but the pupil.
Oh, okay. Okay. Ben, hit the button.
Get us out of here. Eject, eject.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.